The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Sunday nights, Monday mornings, or Tuesday afternoons. You can listen to 60 Minutes whenever you want with the weekly podcast from CBS News.
How do we know you're telling the truth?
Because I have no reason to lie.
With hard-hitting investigative reports, interviews, and profiles.
Did these documents that you got prove corruption?
Oh, absolutely.
From a variety of CBS News correspondents and contributors.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
For the biggest scoops and the best storytelling, subscribe to the 60 Minutes podcast today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Brett Kavanaugh's future in the hands of a divided Senate.
The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the gallery.
And the new hazards of answering phones on Capitol Hill.
Staffers have been threatened with rape and things like that in light of these Kavanaugh hearings.
Plus, the slow recovery from an earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia.
This city of more than 350,000 people has no running water or electricity. Food is scarce, and so are the tools to recover the dead.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
On this vote, the yeas are 51, the noes are 49, the motion is agreed to.
He survived a procedural vote in the Senate, teeing up a final Senate vote on his nomination to the Supreme Court Saturday. Protesters have swarmed senators, calling for the Senate to vote down Kavanaugh's nomination. Here's correspondent Nicole Killian with more from Capitol Hill.
The Senate voted to limit debate on Judge Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination, clearing the way for a final vote expected tomorrow. GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski voted no, and Democratic Senator Joe Manchin voted yes. Before the vote, Senate leaders presented their version of closing arguments.
Everyone is innocent until proven guilty.
Judge Kavanaugh presented to the Senate the bitterest partisan testimony I have ever heard coming from a candidate seeking the Senate's approval.
Is that justice?
Kavanaugh opponents protested through the night and confronted Republican Senator Orrin Hatch.
Are you saying her accusations are false?
Yeah, I think some of them are.
A Republican summary of the investigation revealed the FBI interviewed 10 people who might have had firsthand knowledge of the sexual assault allegations by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez.
Democrats claim the report is incomplete, and CBS News has confirmed the FBI limited its scope at the direction of Republicans and the White House.
This confirmation process has become a national disgrace.
In an op-ed released Thursday night, Kavanaugh admitted he might have been too emotional at times last week. I know that my tone was sharp, and I said a few things I should not have said. Following the vote, President Trump tweeted that he is proud of the U.S. Senate for voting yes to advance Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. Nicole Killian, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
On Friday afternoon, Maine Republican Susan Collins announced her decision on Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The senator will suspend. The sergeant-at-arms will suspend until the sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the gallery.
Collins said she'd vote to confirm Kavanaugh.
The allegations fail to meet the more likely than not standard. Therefore, I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent Judge Kavanaugh from serving on the court.
Correspondent Allison Keyes has been covering Kavanaugh's confirmation. Allison, how do you think this has politicized the Supreme Court, a body that is supposed to be independent and fair?
I think that there are a lot of questions about that. Many Democrats in their testimony brought up the fact that he attacked the Democratic Party. And since the Supreme Court is supposed to be the court of the country that is completely nonpartisan, there are a lot of people that are concerned about that. Republicans, of course, say that everything's fine. He's just going to vote along constitutional lines. But there are concerns both from Democrats and from some Supreme Court experts that I've heard over the past couple of days that say this is a man that became angry and public. This is a man that brought up all sorts of conspiracy theories involving Democrats at that Senate hearing last week. So it's a question as to what would happen if he is confirmed to the court.
We've been hearing stories from more women coming forward to share their own accounts of sexual assault. What effect do you think Christine Blasey Ford's allegation against Kavanaugh has had?
I think the effect of her allegation, for one thing, it galvanized a lot of women who had not had anything to say about what happened to them to come forward. There were people all over Twitter and all over social media who said, yes, this happened to me too. But it's a little bit beyond the Me Too movement, because these are women who are professional women, who are afraid of losing their jobs, who are afraid of their of the people they say attacked them coming after them. But when this woman sat in that Senate hearing room, you know, with her blonde hair, looking terrified, a lot of people thought, wow, this means that I should come forward and share my story, and maybe I should file charges against my accuser. I think it galvanized a whole movement. But I think it also set up a counter movement, because, as President Trump said the other day, now what happens if you are a boy child or a man who is accused of sexual assault, right? So what does that mean for you? There's been a lot of debate about that on both sides. If you didn't do it and someone says you did do it, then what's your defense? Does that mean that your career should be destroyed? And we should note, of course, that there are victims of sexual abuse of both sexes.
What do you think about gender lines when it comes down to reaction to that testimony from Blasey Ford and from Kavanaugh? Some women were saying if Blasey Ford went in there and testified with the same kind of emotion, perhaps, or reaction that Kavanaugh had, that it would be a different story for her.
I think it's interesting that you said that, because there were a lot of people comparing her testimony to Anita Hill, obviously, who testified against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. And Anita Hill went in with this very professional, very calm demeanor, and people felt that if she had been more emotional, they said, that outcome would have been different. But I think that by my watching it, and from what I've heard from some other journalists that I've spoken to, people think that Ford was trying to walk a very difficult line. As a woman who's been assaulted, of course you're emotional about what happened to you. But on the other hand, you can't be a hot crying mess, because you're in a room where all the Republicans on that committee were men, and older men who tend not to believe accusations of that sort. I spoke to people of both sexes who watched that hearing, and the thing that struck me was more women were angry about the way Kavanaugh responded with anger, the way that he attacked some senators. So the women I spoke to were kind of offended by that, but the men I spoke to were like, well, heck yeah, if this isn't true, then he should have responded with that kind of fury, because that's what I would have done if someone had said that I had attacked someone when I did not attack them.
How much of an impact, then, do you think this vote has on elections next month?
I think, depending upon who is able to get the most people to the polls, it may have a huge effect on the election. But, you know, the nation has such a short attention span. If this confirmation happens and it's then off the radar and we're off to the races on some other thing, you know, it depends upon how many ads you run. It depends upon how many things you have going on social media. But it really depends upon whether Democrats or Republicans are able to get more people out to the polls in November.
Correspondent Allison Keyes on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, Allison.
You're welcome.
Now to another story that broke Friday afternoon. The verdict in the trial of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, charged with murder in the shooting death of teenager Laquan McDonald.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of second-degree murder.
Van Dyke shot the black teenager 16 times in 2014. Coming up, the future of trade in North America. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
The president says he'll sign a new trade deal to replace NAFTA by the end of next month before sending it to Congress. Here's correspondent Angelica Alvarez.
President Trump says the new free trade agreement reached between the United States, Mexico, and Canada is a terrific and historic deal.
This is good for everybody. This is good for Canada, good for Mexico also.
The deal replaces NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The USMCA, or United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, gives American farmers greater access to the Canadian dairy market.
They're going to be treated with respect. They're going to be treated fairly.
It also makes it harder for automakers to build cars cheaply in Mexico by requiring a higher number of parts in cars to be made in areas paying a minimum wage of at least $16. In return, Canada and Mexico will be protected from possible tariffs on automobiles imported into the United States.
It's an agreement that will be profoundly beneficial for our economy, for Canadian families, and for the middle class.
But if Democrats take back the House in midterm elections, they could impose additional requirements before ratifying any agreement. Even with this deal, the contentious fight over steel and aluminum remains unresolved. Canada did not receive assurances the Trump administration would lift tariffs on those imports. Angelica Alvarez, CBS News, The White House.
Federal authorities say a Logan, Utah man was behind suspicious letters addressed to the Pentagon and White House. Correspondent Jeff Pegues reports the FBI has been searching his home there.
U.S. attorney in Utah says William Clyde Allen, a Navy veteran, is being held related to the investigation. Law enforcement officials are concerned there are potentially hazardous chemicals in his house and are asking the public to stay away. The mail sent to the Pentagon was addressed to Defense Secretary James Mattis and to the Chief of Naval Operations John Richardson, but was intercepted at the Pentagon's mail delivery center before it could be delivered. The letter addressed to the White House was also intercepted. The two letters sent to the Pentagon initially tested positive for the poison ricin, but law enforcement officials said that was a false alarm after an FBI lab found that the suspicious substance was castor seeds from which ricin is derived. The Centers for Disease Control says it would take a deliberate act to produce it. It's unclear if the suspect tried to make ricin and failed, or if he just wanted to send a message. Frank Salufo is a former Homeland Security official.
Ricin is incredibly toxic. So just the smallest amounts, either inhaled or ingested or injected, could be truly fatal.
Allen served in the Navy for 4 years, leaving the service in 2002. He has not yet been charged, and the motive remains under investigation. Jeff Pegues, CBS News, Washington.
A South Carolina city is coming together after a gunman ambushed police, killing one and wounding six others Wednesday.
Hard and difficult day for us.
Overcome with grief, Major Mike Nunn of the Florence County Sheriff's Office recounted the tragedy that unfolded as his deputies approached the home.
At approximately 4 p.m., suspect inside the residence opened fire on the investigators. Three of our deputies were shot.
Police officers from the city of Florence responded as backup, and four of them were shot.
We have an officer down at this time. Suspect still firing. Use precaution.
Fire was being shot all over. The way the suspect was positioned, his view of fire was several hundred yards, and the officers couldn't get to the ones that's down.
Police were forced to use a bulletproof truck to rescue the wounded officers. The suspect allegedly held children hostage while barricading himself inside the home. The standoff lasted for about 2 hours, and then the suspect surrendered.
Today we lost a good friend of mine.
Florence Police Chief Alan Heidler was unable to fight back tears as he described the fallen police officer, Terrence Carraway, who served on the force for more than 30 years. Heidler called him and the rest of the wounded officers family.
Pray for these officers and their speedy recovery. Pray for the family who lost the bravest police officer that I have ever known.
Correspondent David Begno reporting. President Trump awarded the highest military honor Monday to former Army Staff Sergeant Ron Scherer for his bravery in Afghanistan, calling him an inspiration. Pentagon correspondent David Martin reports what Scherer faced in the war zone and the struggle he's now fighting.
A team of Green Berets and Afghan commandos went in by helicopter to capture or kill suspected Afghan terrorist leaders. But for Staff Sergeant Ronald Scherer, that day in the spring of 2008 became a five-hour battle to save the lives of his own men.
For me personally, it just became a mission of just getting as many guys out of there as I could.
The enemy held the high ground, and the Green Berets were under withering fire. Scherer was the team's medic.
Ron raced to each patient, giving them life-saving care. They were bleeding profusely.
I heard the first calls for medic. And at that point, worked my way over to the first person.
Did you have to expose yourself to fire to get there?
Yes. I mean, I had to get there.
Did you get hit?
I know when I was shot in the helmet.
And were you okay?
Felt like somebody hit me in the helmet with a baseball bat.
While Apache helicopters rocketed the village and jets dropped bombs within danger close range, Scherer kept moving across open ground to treat the wounded. Medevacs braved the firestorm.
Hey, I'm hit. I think I'm hit.
to evacuate the casualties Schorr had treated.
Not a single American died in that brutal battle, thanks in great measure to Ron's heroic actions.
Schorr got out of the Army and joined the Secret Service. When the president told him he would be receiving the Medal of Honor...
Once he said Medal of Honor, I was so confused that I really don't remember what else he said.
Confused? Why confused?
To be singled out at all just doesn't make sense.
There's one other thing about 39-year-old Ronald Schorr that won't make sense to anyone.
I was diagnosed with lung cancer last year.
What's the prognosis?
Taking it one day at a time.
He's faced death before and knows exactly what he has to do.
We're just giving this fight everything we can, just like the last one.
David Martin, Washington.
Three International Space Station crew members are back on the ground after more than 6 months in orbit.
It was a perfect landing in Kazakhstan.
Ricky, how was the ride down?
Great.
Americans Ricky Arnold and Drew Feustel and their Soyuz commander Oleg Artemyev spent 197 days aboard the space station, all three appearing fit as they headed into medical exams and then reunions with their families. The trio left three crew members behind, but they will be joined by an astronaut and a cosmonaut in a week. Peter King, CBS News.
Up next, the rising death toll and slow response to the Indonesian earthquake and tsunami.
The Indonesian military has been moving people out of the disaster zone, but there is growing criticism they have been too slow to move in supplies for survivors.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
The death toll's rising now, over 1,500 people from an earthquake and tsunami that hit Indonesia's Sulawesi Island. Correspondent Ben Tracy is covering the painful recovery in Palu.
Gas stations in Palu are running on empty. This man named Ari waited 14 hours only to find out there won't be any fuel deliveries today.
How hard is it to live in this town right now?
I don't know, maybe it's chaos.
The Indonesian military has been moving people out of the disaster zone, but there is growing criticism they have been too slow to move in supplies for survivors. This city of more than 350,000 people has no running water or electricity. Food is scarce, and so are the tools to recover the dead.
This is one of the areas that was hardest hit by the tsunami. You don't see heavy machinery here. You see people just using their bare hands to dig through debris, trying to find bodies.
I can't swim. Water here.
Nearby, we met this woman, Aldiani. She survived the tsunami that devastated Palu's beachfront. But she lost five family members, including her father and mother.
Ben Tracy reporting. The Catholic Church sex abuse scandal has cast a cloud over a meeting of bishops at the Vatican.
Pope Francis prayed with bishops who've gathered from nearly 125 countries. Their goal? Making the church more appealing to youth. Topics range from migration to LGBT issues to video games. But there's a major one missing.
Sex abuse is not officially on the docket in this meeting with bishops, but these sex abuse survivors are trying to make sure that it's part of the discussion.
Protesters gathered near the Vatican, about two dozen of them from a Catholic school, for the hearing impaired. Even when I sleep, I'm not tranquil, Johnny Bizzoli said. He and three other sex abuse survivors from the Antonio Provolo Institute for the Deaf in Verona, Italy, pointed to their priest abusers. I would scream and cry out because of the pain, Alessandro Vantini told us, but no one could hear me because everyone was deaf. In 2013 and 2014, they wrote to the Pope warning of pedophile priests at the school, asking how they could live in tranquility. In 2016, they got a response from the Vatican, noting how much the Holy See has done and continues to do in relation to clerical sex abuse. Pier Paolo Zanatta told us talking to the Vatican feels like talking to a wall. One of the priests who abused Gianni Bisoli, Father Nicola Corradi, was transferred to another institute for the hearing impaired in Argentina, where he abused more kids. In 2016, he was arrested on allegations he'd abused 22 deaf-mute children over 30 years. Seth Doan, CBS News, Rome.
The First Lady's wrapping up her tour in Africa that began with a somber visit to slave sites in Ghana.
The First Lady's visit to former slave castles in Ghana Wednesday was a sobering reminder of America's painful history of slavery. Cape Coast Castle was the point of no return for slaves. They were kept in dungeons before being shipped to the U.S. Melania Trump called the tour of the 17th century castle very emotional. Mrs. Trump arrived on her outreach to Africa Tuesday as part of her Be Best campaign aimed at children. She was welcomed to Ghana in colorful style and greeted by the country's First Lady, Rebecca Akufo-Addo. Africa is well-traveled terrain for U.S. First Ladies.
Girls who are not being an
Michelle Obama, Hillary Clinton,
educated women,
and Laura Bush all made this continent a top priority. Laura Bush's former chief of staff, Anita McBride, says they were often more popular than their husbands when traveling abroad.
Well, this is a perfect role for a First Lady of the United States to really be a softening tone or a gentler tone and to build bridges.
Mending bridges might be the unspoken message of the First Lady's African tour. Her trip comes with a lot of baggage, not least of all President Trump's disparaging comments about the continent earlier this year. Critics have noted the First Lady's trip appears to be out of step with some of her husband's policies. Many of her planned events highlight programs funded by U.S. aid, even though the Trump administration has proposed slashing the organization's budget. Deborah Patter, CBS News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Folks in Vegas marked 1 year Monday since a gunman opened fire at a concert, killing 58 people. Our Steve Futterman was there.
The tributes began before sunrise and lasted late into the night. For those who lost loved ones, the anniversary brought back the painful memories.
I miss my daughter so much.
I miss my daughter immensely.
The day included the dedication of a wall of remembrance at the city's Garden of Healing. This survivor attended the ceremony.
My name could have been up there. Or my wife's.
The final tributes were timed to occur at the precise moment that the gunshots rang out a year ago. A human chain was formed around the concert site. Some of the famous hotel marquee signs along the Vegas Strip turned to black. And each of those killed,
Tara Rowe, 34,
had their names read in tribute. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Las Vegas.
Susan Smith, 53.
The woman who claims soccer superstar Cristiano Ronaldo raped her in Las Vegas back in 2009 now says the alleged assault left her with PTSD. She wants an 8-year-old legal settlement of her charges thrown out.
Ronaldo through the line! Cristiano Ronaldo!
He's considered by many to be one of the greatest goal scorers of all time. Now, Cristiano Ronaldo is playing defense against allegations he sexually assaulted a woman in Las Vegas.
She has suffered psychological injury.
Catherine Mayorga first told the German publication Der Spiegel about the night she says the Portuguese soccer player raped her. The night still haunts her, according to her lawyer, Leslie Stovall.
Depression, suicidal ideation, abuse of alcohol, problems in maintaining personal relationships and employment.
In 2010, she reached an agreement with his attorneys to accept $375,000 to keep quiet about their alleged encounter. Mayorga is now seeking more than $200,000 in a lawsuit, claiming she lacked the mental capacity to participate in negotiations due to the injuries suffered. On Twitter Wednesday, Ronaldo said his conscience was clear, writing, "I firmly deny the accusations being issued against me."
Ronaldo has multiple endorsement deals, including Nike, which is reportedly worth $1 billion. Nike says it's taking these allegations seriously and will continue to monitor the situation. Jamie Yuccas, CBS News, Las Vegas.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, the work hazards of taking calls in Congress.
A lot of violent threats do happen on these phone calls, and the staffers just have to keep up this professional demeanor.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Hundreds of millions of people with some 75% of cell phones in the U.S. got an alert testing a system that could be used by the president in the event of a national emergency. Here's correspondent Anna Werner.
When the alert went off, it wasn't immediately obvious in places like Santa Monica and at New York's Grand Central Station, where this couple said they knew it was coming.
We were forewarned about it. It had been in the paper and everything, so it was no big shock.
There it is.
Got it.
But it became a moment on TV.
It's very quiet.
And on Twitter, where the hashtag presidential alert was trending and generated jokes and memes, with the Houston Zoo sending a cute baby elephant alert and the New York Mets saying this is not a test. Jacob deGrom is the best pitcher in baseball. It's similar to the local amber and weather alerts sent to mobile phones. Planning for the alert system began in 2006. But some people said their phones didn't go off. 12 minutes after the alert, we asked the Duncans.
Did you get the alert?
No.
You didn't? What service are you on?
T-Mobile.
Officials say if you do ever see a real presidential alert, pay attention. FEMA's Antoine Johnson.
Take those things very seriously when they come across your mobile device or it appears on radio and television. They're not the type of alerts that should be ignored at any time.
FEMA said the test was successful. Phone carriers, including T-Mobile, told us it may have taken up to 30 minutes for alerts to go through, but T-Mobile said it had no problems outside of that. If you were on an active phone call at the time, you may not have gotten the alert, but otherwise, there's no way to opt out of the alerts. Anna Werner, CBS News, New York.
A new New York Times investigation is casting doubt on President Trump's claims he's a self-made billionaire.
I got a very, very small loan from my father many years ago. I built that into a massive empire, and I paid my father back that loan.
Mr. Trump has said that loan was for $1 million, but according to a New York Times investigation, the president was given or inherited the equivalent of at least $413 million from his father's real estate empire.
Much of his wealth came from what the Times calls dubious tax schemes by the Trump family,
including setting up a sham corporation to disguise gifts from their parents and creating a strategy to undervalue real estate holdings on tax returns. The Times estimates the Trump family avoided paying at least $550 million in gift and inheritance taxes, paying just over $50 million instead. In a tweet, President Trump slammed the Times for doing a, quote, very old, boring, and often told hit piece on me. President Trump has previously boasted of taking advantage of tax laws without breaking them.
I have brilliantly used those laws.
Tax investigators in New York State are now reviewing the allegations. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
It's not a good time to answer the phones on Capitol Hill. Haley Byrd at the Weekly Standard knows why. Haley joins me on the line. Haley, it's been an onslaught of calls to Congress. What's going on and just how busy are the phone lines?
So a lot of offices keep track of how many calls they get per week, usually depending on the topics that Congress is addressing. So in the Senate right now, predictably, you have a lot of calls to key senators about Judge Kavanaugh. And it's just a lot of activism going on that it's questionable how effective this is. But my colleague Tony Mejia and I recently wrote a story about transfer calling and patch-through calls, which is another form of advocacy that different groups use. It's widespread on Capitol Hill, and so some of these are also coming through this week.
Is that a new tactic? Can you explain that?
So it's not new. It's been around for a few years, but a few staffers told us Calls in general have gone up since Trump was elected. You had health care, which was a really tense time on Capitol Hill with a lot of activism. So a lot of these issues, this sort of advocacy has become more widespread. Staffers take issue with it because they say that it doesn't represent constituents fairly, because, you know, basically advocacy groups are recruiting constituents and then patching them through to their congressmen if they agree with them on a subject.
Can you give me a sense of how inundated Congress is right now with these calls? And do you have an idea of how well they're keeping up?
So it's sort of tough to say because a lot of this data isn't public. I've heard from some staffers that it's very similar to healthcare, which was just a very hectic time. But putting a number on it is really difficult.
And usually it's, I assume, low-level staffers taking these phone calls at first.
Yeah, so these are like 22 to 24-year-olds, most of them, who take these phone calls, which can be stressful for them because, you know, you have Susan Collins' office saying that a lot of their female staffers have been threatened with rape and things like that in light of these Kavanaugh hearings. A lot of violent threats do happen on these phone calls, and the staffers just have to keep up this professional demeanor when speaking to these constituents. And it depends on whether actually the callers are living in the state or not, because senators don't really take into account if it's an out-of-state caller, because they want to cater to the people who actually live where they represent.
But you're seeing a more organized attempt at these deluges of phone calls.
Sure. And one thing that we noticed in reporting this story is that it really happens for a lot of niche political issues. Like I said, net neutrality, appropriations bills, where basically an organization, like a telemarketer situation happens, where they will call up a constituent and say, hey, how do you feel about DACA? Do you think that these immigrants should stay here? What do you think? And then the person on the other end of the line will say something. Usually they're confused, at which point the telemarketer will patch them through to their member of Congress. And confusion, I would say, is one of the key giveaways for congressional staffers here, because the constituent on the other end of the line doesn't really know what's happening a lot of the time. All they know is that they were called. So the conversation oftentimes goes a little bit like, hello? And the staffer on the other side is, hi, you've reached the congressman's office. Do you need anything? And then the constituent says, no, you called me. And so that sort of confusion really gives away to staffers that this is not as authentic as it would like the advocacy groups would like for them to think it is. Other times, you know, the constituents actually just outright say, you know, I was told to tell you this, and I actually think this. One staffer told me that they had gotten a call, one of these patch-through calls, where a constituent had been told to tell them to oppose tax cuts back in the winter. And the constituent said, you know, they told me to tell you I don't like tax cuts, but I do sort of like tax cuts. So there is some room for error in these calls.
Trial by fire, trial by phone on Capitol Hill Weekly. Standard reporter Haley Byrd on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, Haley.
Thank you.
Coming up, learning in a flood zone.
7-year-old Masamit Reka is learning her ABCs inside a floating classroom docked near her home in Bangladesh.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters Podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters Podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Police say they had never seen anything so horrific. A woman found dead in her Hollywood condo. 48 Hours correspondent Maureen Maher investigates. Maureen, what made this murder so disturbing?
Well, it was disturbing in the way that she was killed. It's called exsanguination, which is a new word for me after being a crime reporter for 25 years. Even the cops said they'd never heard of it. And it's when somebody dies by all of the blood being let out of their body. So the cops said they'd never seen anything like this. They had a pretty good idea right from the beginning who they thought it was, but they couldn't figure out how it was done or why it was done. And that's really the mystery here this week.
Tell me about this woman and who her boyfriend at the time was.
Her name is Yana Kassian. She's 28 years old. She is an immigrant from the Ukraine. Her boyfriend at the time is a man named Blake Leibel. He is a very wealthy, a trust funder from Toronto. Blake and Yana meet up and they have a baby. And within a few weeks, the happy home life changes dramatically. And the question is there something in Cody's life, Blake's brother, who is involved with the Molly's game, the very highly publicized, high-stakes celebrity poker game? Was there something in Molly's game that Cody was involved with that had something to do with this horrific, unspeakable murder? Or is it something in Blake's life? Blake is the co-author of a book called Syndrome, and it is a graphic novel.
What about the Russian mob? Did that come into play in Cody's life?
So Cody, as I said, was a player in Molly's game. And if anyone knows anything about it, that's the game that Molly Bloom was running. And when she comes to the New York area, there was an indictment that the Russian mafia was involved with it. Cody Leibel reportedly owed as much as $1 million at one time to the game and potentially to the mob. And so Blake had it in his head a year or so before the murder that the Russian mafia was going to come after him because he was related to Cody. And that's how the whole idea of Molly's game gets even introduced to this case.
And you mentioned the rocky relationship that Blake had. Did he have an affair?
So Blake was married to a model named Amanda Braun, and she's pregnant with their second child. And he leaves a few weeks before that baby is born, and he takes up with another woman he was having an affair with. And then he leaves her, and he starts up with Yana Kassian. So he basically still has all three women in his life at the time of the murder. It is an unwieldy love-hate quadrangle, if you will.
And lots for police to investigate.
Yes.
48 Hours correspondent Maureen Maher's Hollywood Horror Story. You can catch 48 Hours on Saturday nights or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Thanks, Maureen.
My pleasure.
A new way to bring schools to students in Bangladesh. More from CBS's Tina Krause.
7-year-old Masamit Rekha is learning her ABCs inside a floating classroom docked near her home in Bangladesh. I love school, she says. We can attend even during the rainy season when our homes are flooded. One-third of the South Asian country goes underwater during the 5-month monsoon season, and many parents are unable or unwilling to send their children to school. So a local architect came up with a novel solution.
If the children cannot go to school for lack of transportation, then the school should go to them.
Mohammed Rezwan started with just one boat 16 years ago, but now has a fleet of more than 100 that gives stranded students an opportunity to learn. The wooden boats use solar power and cell technology to provide internet access and training to thousands of kids and adults. They're also equipped with play sets, giving students a chance to take a break from their schoolwork. UN experts warn 20 million people in Bangladesh could become climate refugees by the end of the century, forced from their homes as rivers swallow up towns. Mother of two, Mosamit Yarna, says the floating space is a symbol of hope, no matter how her country's landscape changes in the future. Tina Krause, CBS News.
Jeffrey the giraffe may not be out of the job for too long. Correspondent Steve Kathan explains why.
A group of investors has scrapped the planned auction of Toys R Us intellectual property assets, even though several bids came in. Instead, it's now working on a plan to try to revive the retail chain rather than selling its parts. The investors want to work with other partners here and overseas to, in their words, bring back these iconic brands in a new and reimagined way. Toys R Us and Babies R Us liquidated all stores and filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
That's the reaction from Amazon workers in Eastvale, California, after hearing they'll get raises. The company says it's raising its minimum wage in the U.S. to $15 an hour starting next month for some 350,000 employees. Finally this week, a team stands up for a homeless high school athlete with a bright future. Here's correspondent Jim Axelrod.
When the Balloon Knights captured a last-second 29-26 win over their Washington, D.C. rival, Roosevelt High.
We did it, baby. We got the W.
No one loved it more than senior running back Jamal Speaks.
It's a blessing. I'm just happy to be here.
And not just because he rushed for one TD and set up the game winner with this great catch, but because this was Speaks' first game in two seasons. Teammate Milan Womack.
It was just fun to have my brother back.
No, Speaks wasn't injured. That would be easy to understand. He'd been ruled ineligible to play. Not because of bad grades, he's a good student, or discipline issues, he's a great kid, but because with his father dead and his mother not in his life, he was homeless, bouncing from friend's house to friend's house. The school ruled no permanent address meant he couldn't play. In this are-you-kidding-me scenario, the adults may not have had a clue, but the kids did. Last game, they refused to take the field for 45 minutes in protest. Tajay Ruffin plays safety.
If anybody was in his shoes, we would have did the same thing for anybody.
With the light now shining on Jamal's situation, he's allowed to play, at least for the time being.
People accept me for who I am, man. What I'm doing, like, I appreciate it. It's just a lot of love.
Temple University sure did, giving him a football scholarship and the rest of us a running back to root hard for in the seasons to come. Jim Axelrod, CBS News, New York.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show is always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.